You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Amanda King, and in this episode, ECSP Senior Fellow Sherry Goodman joins me in a conversation with Jonathan Pershing, Program Director of Environment at the Hewlett Foundation. If you've been paying attention to climate, Jonathan's name will be familiar to you. He's a veteran diplomat who has served under four presidents, including as Special Envoy for Climate Change during the Obama administration and Deputy Special Envoy under the Biden administration, working to support Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kerry. At Hewlett, Jonathan is back in a role he served in from 2017 to 2021, leading a team of grantmakers focused on climate in the U.S., China, India, Europe, and Latin America. With the 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference underway in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, our conversation touches on progress made and needed for international climate commitments, the role of critical minerals in meeting the green energy transition, notable climate-related migration trends, and opportunities for global climate collaboration. Jonathan, it's great to have you join us today. Thank you for taking the time to meet with both Sherry and me for this episode. You've been a longtime leader in advancing international climate commitments between your experience supporting Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kerry, serving as the Special Envoy for Climate Change at the U.S. State Department, and being a lead U.S. negotiator to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or the UNFCCC. Your expertise is both expansive and one that we're glad to hear from today. So I wanted to start with a question about progress. So as COP27 starts in just a few days, and you're instrumental in the Glasgow Climate Pact, what progress are you most excited about? And where do you see more progress needed when it comes to current international climate commitments?
So thanks very much, Amanda. And thanks, Sherry, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think that this is an issue which has got increasing salience as we move forward. And in some ways, what's useful to do to think about both for this meeting coming up now in Egypt, but for the larger agenda, is think about why that has increasingly become relevant and what kinds of things the global community is worried about and therefore has elevated the profile. The first one is that over the last couple of years, there's been quite a lot of new and more in-depth understanding of the science. Things that we used to think were 20 or 30 years into the future are in fact happening today. And one of the areas that we've worked on extensively is something called attribution science, which basically says, are the things that are happening today because of climate change, or would they have happened anyway, and climate's not really a factor in how much they've changed? The answer is that climate change is noticeably changing the extent, the severity, and the frequency of these kinds of events. This last year is a really interesting case in point. We look at a place like Pakistan, which suffered unprecedented flooding. That flooding is deemed to have become much, much more likely because of climate. And the severity is 30 million people displaced in this event. If we start thinking about the scale of kind of the security dimensions of other military or refugee crises or other consequences, you look at someplace like Ukraine now, which has got maybe 5 million people moving. You look at the dynamics of a place like Syria, which was kind of the last round of things that had happened, you had well under 10 million people moving. Just in Pakistan, we've displaced 30 million people. One event, short term. And it doesn't look like they can get back to where they had been very quickly because a great deal of the infrastructure had been completely destroyed. So as we look at these kinds of consequences, this year really feels like a bit of a tipping point in the scale. The second thing which I think is relevant is that a number of solutions to the climate problem have also become more and more evident. The costs have come down, the prices are much more within reach, and it speaks again to multiple factors. At one end, I can now, for example, buy a solar panel and install it or put in a whole array of them in place of a coal-fired or natural gas-fired plant. And the data, according to Bloomberg, the Bloomberg finance team, is that that is cheaper than installing a new gas facility. So now I've got an interesting economic win on my side. That's only happened in the last couple of years. But we're also seeing, and again, to hark back to some of the other security dimensions, we're seeing real opportunities to move away from highly volatile global supply chains, particularly for oil and gas, into things that might be much more domestic. So for example, if I happen to have wind turbines or happen to have a solar array, it's not contingent on the constant availability of gas to the Nord Stream pipeline into Northern Europe. So as Europe looks to manage this crisis of the moment and looks at what it might do, it's aggressively building out options that are not just good for security, but frankly, also good for climate. Those intersections are playing in more places. And then finally, I think what we've got is a set of the coalescence of a series of leaders and heads of state who see these intersections. I would put first and foremost in that the United States, where the discussion over this last year has led to some really substantial bipartisan agreements. If we look at the bills that were passed with Republican and Democratic support, in particular the CHIPS and Science Act and the infrastructure bill, those had substantial Republican and Democratic support for improving U.S. competitiveness, for improving the supply chains, for managing support to the industries that could be the industries of the future. Those things have also shifted the debate, and other countries take note. Countries like India, countries like China, the dynamics inside of Europe, reflecting back on what we've done here. So fast forward then, and we have this major meeting. It occurs every year, but it's in the context of having all of these things happen since the last time we got together in Glasgow in 2021. And these new developments, I think, lend a degree of optimism to intent. At the other side, the meeting has got all sorts of problems. People have not been able to make as much progress as we'd like to have made. The US bill notwithstanding, implementation is going to be hard. We know we've got the money now at the table, but how do you carry it forward? Places like Europe are making major investments in renewables, but it's also looking at the dynamics of near-term energy supply constraints and looking to extend its nuclear facilities and looking to build out some of the coal capacity, at least as a short-term fix. A country like China, with rapidly increasing demand as its economy is slowing down, is still looking at new coal. Those things are also part of the dialogue that are happening at this moment. So I think the meeting at the climate negotiations in Egypt will bring all of this together. Remains to be seen which one is on the ascendant, which one takes the stage. Those kinds of questions are real. Finally, there's a general issue about money and about impact. And that's the other piece that's going to be a big central discussion. There's been a long-standing commitment that the developed world would help the developing world in making a transition. But the developed world has been remarkably slow in raising the capital, the finance, to facilitate this. That's going to be a point of contention. And then finally, as we see these impacts, these things that are in Pakistan, the flooding, the horrible drought and temperature in India, those adaptation questions, these countries are also looking for support in helping them there. And that too will be at the center of the dialogue.
Well, thank you so much. That was a great, great answer, Jonathan. You covered so much of what we want to discuss. If I could just unpack a little bit of that, you know, in the wake of Putin's war on Ukraine and the weaponization of energy to Europe, the early narrative was that we were going to have to build in more reliance on fossil fuels to meet immediate and urgent needs in Europe, and that Asia would be the beneficiary of diversion of Russian oil and then gas up to other theaters. But now we see emerging a somewhat different narrative, which really talks about how we can use this crisis to accelerate through the energy transition, and that Russia ultimately, as a fossil fuel power, is weakened because it will have fewer markets with which to send those resources. So give us your take on those two narratives, if you would.
So listen, I don't think we know the answer yet to that question. I think it's still being played out. We've seen an increasing level of import of Russian oil and gas into India and into China. So that would suggest that the first narrative of a fossil fuel future is more dominant. Having said that, we've also seen in both countries a continued emphasis on renewables. which suggests that while the fossil fuel may be a short-term supply option, neither is looking at it as a long-term solution. So President Modi in India has basically been quite, Prime Minister Modi has been quite explicit that he believes that this 500 gigawatts of new renewable power is one of the legacies he wants to leave from his tenure. And he's aggressively investing in building that out. So gas, which in many cases is an alternative fuel option for electricity, no longer quite as critical. China's also been looking at this. If we look at the total global development of renewable energy and divide up the world into two parts, one part is China, and that is as big, if not bigger, than the rest of the world combined in terms of its installation of new renewable capacity. So it's not that it's slowed down because of Russia. It's not that because it's got gas and oil imports, it's stopped. It's continued on that extraordinary pace. So to me, that suggests that the narrative is much more complicated. Finally, there's a question of what do you need inside these countries to make the alternative work? How long does it take? So supposing I want to buy the Russian oil and gas, and let's use gas in particular as the model. I can run it through LNG, in which case I need to have both the LNG capacity, which Russia currently does not have, and then I need in the host recipient country to be able to take that liquid gas and regasify it, and then run it through a pipeline to get to the power plants that I have installed that could use the gas. None of that really exists to scale up very substantially. So in all of those cases, it looks like a much more expensive proposition to scale up than it does to build out the renewable options that these countries are contemplating.
So let's ask, so follow on to that, to make the green transition really work, we also have to green the critical minerals supply chain, a subject in which I know you're deeply interested in, Jonathan. So talk to us about, tell us about your thinking on how we are going to onshore, friendshore, and sort of make work in the context of our climate goals, the additional mining, processing, manufacturing we'll need for everything from lithium to cobalt to rare earth minerals to power the batteries, magnets, and other parts of the renewable energy infrastructure we so desperately need.
I think, Sherry, that this is a topic that has been given much less attention than it deserves. We tend to think that the various elements that comprise this new supply chain will be available. At the scale we are currently working, they have been available, so it's not like it's an irrational thought. But at the scale we intend to be, they're not available. It looks like in many, many cases, we will have supply constraints within the next decade, and they get more severe in the out years as we further grow the capacity. There are a number of NGOs, we're beginning to work with a number of them that are thinking about these agendas. I mean, folks at the Wilson Center are thinking about this, folks at Rocky Mountain Institute are thinking about this. There's some really, really interesting work that's happening at the World Resources Institute. There's some work that's happening at CSIS, which is a think tank that looks at security. On the European side, there are organizations like the Climate Works, the European Climate Foundation, organizations like Agora. The Japanese are thinking about this. So it's people are thinking about it, but it feels nascent. So what are the issues that I think we have to worry about? You've laid them out, I think, quite explicitly. One of the scenarios that we see is going to be, where will these minerals come from? So in some cases, for example, like where I put a power line, I can move the power line depending on political interests. I can put it over, 100 miles to the north or 100 miles to the south. I don't actually have that flexibility when it comes to a mine. I can't move the mine. The minerals are where the minerals are, and I have to go to those places to pull them out. And the question then is, where are those minerals? They're global. The U.S. has a share, although not a very large share. If you look at the U.S. Geological Survey data, they have a share, but only a piece of the total, which means for the U.S. to build out its capacity, it'll take a global network. They come from places like Australia. Those are friends. They're interested in the mining option. They can perhaps advance and move that forward. They come from places like Chile and Argentina, both places where we've had long-term relationships, but quite frankly, where increasingly the supply chain is owned by China. So we have some real constraints there. They come from places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which, as it expends its mining operations, has had a number of problems, not least with deforestation. There have been accusations of the use of child labor. There are a whole series of constraints that underlie some of those supply chains. I don't think we've yet thought through either the politics or the diplomacy or the assistance programs that are going to be required as we seek to expand that. And then, Sherry, you raised another point, which I think is critical, and that's the question of siting. The United States has historically been very reluctant over the last couple of decades to site new facilities that are likely going to be really important in the context of these transitions. And I mean everything from new mines to processing centers to transmission lines to solar fields that or wind turbine fields that might need to dot either the offshore spaces or some parts of the American continent. Until we figure that out, I think we won't be able to make the kind of transition that we need. And that brings a whole host of people to the table, people with real concerns about the bad history of some of these operations. Mines have not been particularly notorious for being good environmental citizens. They've left tailing or tip heaps. They've left waste pools. They've contaminated groundwater. So it's not a great record. How do you persuade communities that we can move forward? How do I want to think about a power line that runs through my backyard? Those are legitimate questions we're going to have to manage as we think about this transition.
I want to ask one more follow-up on that, and then I'm going to turn it back to Amanda, which is, you know, I agree that that has been the narrative. And so I want to plant a seed with you, Jonathan, and for our listeners here today, because I believe this is one of the most vital areas we face in the renewable energy transition, and spending a lot of time with the Department of Defense, who's really trying to lead from the front, this is going to be critical in the defense logistics supply chain in just a few short years. So the narrative that you describe of mine being seen as environmental bad actors does not, and the whole processing and manufacturing does not have to be the case going forward. Just think about how we've changed, begun to shift the narrative on nuclear energy in this country as a critical component of the clean energy transition to meet the climate crisis with new technologies, safer, managing waste in an appropriate way with appropriate ESG principles all about it. The possibility here exists, and I will welcome your comment on it, that one of the things we need to do is talk about sustainable mining and mineral extraction in order to provide jobs, but good jobs for people in the right places to support this clean energy transition.
I think that the general thesis is exactly right. I don't think there's a way to solve this unless we do that. I think there are a couple of elements that we ought to worry about quite specifically. The idea of sustainable mining is a little bit of a misnomer. We're taking a non-renewable resource and we're going to use it. Now, you can recycle an awful lot of it, and we do very, very little recycling. But we know we need more of the raw material. Right. But you can do it so much better than we've done it historically. We know how to do it better. And I think if we actually combine the lessons that we've learned about managing lands, the lessons that we've learned about cleanup, the lessons we've learned about processing in the new industry, it would be a fabulous opportunity. It would grow economic capacity. It would grow local development programs often in communities that don't have those kinds of options. So I think there's a huge potential here. But if we do it without the safeguards, if we do it without consideration, I think the reputation that has historically been attached to the sector will continue and will actually shut down what we will need to have to make the transition. So I think this is a moment where those decisions are absolutely essential.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And as you mentioned, critical minerals and the energy transition is something we're definitely focusing on here at the Wilson Center. We have an ongoing partnership with the U.S. Agency for International Development, looking at kind of development's role with critical minerals, but also, like you said, the whole process from communities to actual technology and where it starts with mining until the end. And I'm actually curious, you kind of mentioned it, about China's role with critical minerals. You know, you were a part of the joint declaration between the U.S. and China on enhancing climate action. And also the U.S. State Department has their new mineral security partnership. So I was just curious your perspective on kind of where China fits in with both minerals, but also ongoing partnerships in this clean energy transition.
So thanks, Amanda. I think this is a complicated story. Let me put a couple of just short comments on the table about it. The first one is that China actually has built out long-term contracts for mineral resources around the world. It is the largest holder of assets for everything from lithium to copper to cobalt. It has done long-term contracts every place from Chile to the DRC to South Africa. So as we look at these are areas where the United States and many of the OECD countries have not made investments or adopted contracts. Large-scale multinational mining companies are very, very seldom American. There's some Canadian ones and there's some Australian ones, but there's an awful lot more who are not, who are part of a different supply chain structure, which is not part of one the US is in. I think that's gonna have to change if we wanna have the sense of reliability about the system. I think the second point is that the Chinese have been way ahead of the rest of the world, not just in the supply chain, but in the installation side. So if we take a look at where the numbers are, China's got a substantial share of the installed renewable fleet. China has a substantial share of the installed light-duty vehicles. There are more electric cars in China than there are in the rest of the world. So again, on this demand side, they've been leaders. Now, the U.S. is playing catch-up. And I think a lot of the things that happened in the last round of bills give us a very clear sense that the U.S. intends to play very aggressively in that domain. I think that's great. I think that'll lead to a level of competitiveness, which ultimately I think will serve the U.S. quite well. I don't think it has to be a race to the bottom. I think it can be kind of a race to the top and looking at what we would do compounded by what China does, compounded by what Japan and Europe do. That's the model we'd like to have to try to address this climate change problem. But it could lead to really increased economic development, increased capacity if we do it right. This brings us back then to China. What's the US relationship with China? I think it's been fairly clearly articulated by everyone from Secretary Blinken to President Biden. It's some combination of competition with collaboration and in some cases, direct disagreement. I don't think that's about to change. The question for me is within this climate domain, how much room is there for collaboration and on what kinds of issues might collaboration occur? I don't think it'll occur in areas the United States is trying to compete. It won't occur in things like artificial intelligence. It won't occur in places where we are worried about security risks, for example, to our grid. But it could occur in places where we talk about policy, in places where the exchange of information about how you do things more efficiently on mining operations to make them environmentally sound. That could be a place where cooperation could happen much, much more extensively. I think it could occur in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, where we look at how do we minimize deforestation as we open up access to minerals. That's a place that it could occur. So I'm looking for these kinds of areas where it doesn't conflict with the underlying security tensions between the countries, but yet offers real opportunity to transition to the future that we must have. We should be clear. The dynamics of climate, and I'm gonna go back to that first comment I made about Pakistan, that's like 30 million people, one event. And we should be very clear, that is not the worst it's going to be. That's this year with about 1.1 degrees of warming. We're looking at 1.5 to 2 or more degrees of warming in the next few decades. Pakistan is the least of our worries. We're gonna have one of those on a regular, recurring basis. I don't think that gives us a lot of room to pretend it's not a real security threat or real environmental threat or real economic threat. It is all of those. And the relationship with China is going to be pivotal to solving it.
Okay. Well, let me ask you further on the migration question, which is so fundamental to our future. As you noted, in Pakistan, we have 30 million who are displaced. And many of them, you know, are not in refugee camps. They're internally displaced. And we also have a global kind of increasing climate migration challenge that is, as you noted, is we're probably at the best it's going to be, and it's probably going to accelerate. So I know you care deeply about how we think about this in a very scientific and factual way in data. And how are you thinking Jonathan, in terms of both the data and the frameworks that we need to better develop to understand and manage the governance associated with climate migration? If that's too big a question, I apologize.
Well, it's a huge, but I think increasingly ripe question, Sherry. I don't think that the global community has really done much work on this. It's so contentious. We look at the thousands of people moving across borders today and the difficulties that countries from the United States to Europe have had over the last decades on this. And some people are more welcome than others. I look at Europe and Syria, not too welcome. I look at Europe and Ukrainians, slightly more welcome. I look at people with high net worth, they're often invited. We've got different models for how we have thought about this. But globally, we are clearly seeing testing of governance institutions and structure as people move. It's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. The kinds of models that we've got, the UNHCR, which is the Committee on Refugees under the United Nations, I don't think is prepared. I think our ability to set up refugee camps has been inadequate. In many cases, we have not found solutions for long-term resettlement. There are generations of children growing up in these camps who've been there for decades, literally decades. They're almost now communities on their own, cities on their own, but with services that are inadequate, and they breed resentment, and they create strife and are fomenting grounds for terrorism, as well as a lost opportunity for children who could become contributing members of any society, but are prevented from taking that forward. These are enormous questions. I think the world's going to have to start thinking about it. I don't think it's done a good job. I'm going to be partly through the UN. I'm going to be partly through those border areas where there's going to be a most intense need. I look, for example, at Pakistan and India. Will the Pakistanis move to India? Not likely, given the current tensions with the Islamic community in Pakistan and the Hindu community in India and the disagreements on the Modi government side. Will the Latins who are threatened by hurricanes move into the United States? That looks increasingly difficult as the United States has been very reluctant to have large-scale migratory patterns. Will it move from North Africa into Europe? What we've seen, at least historically, is enormous resistance to that. And the closer you are to the borders and the more you have to pay, the harder it is to make that transition. And we're seeing a very great difficulty in Europe of moving resources from places like Germany to places on the border like Greece. Those are going to get worse. And I don't think we know how to handle it.
Amanda, maybe you want to provide Jonathan sort of the last positive question so we can end on a positive note.
Yeah. Did you want to talk about the methane pledge at all? Is that a hopeful or is that a maybe not?
More hopeful.
Okay.
Maybe I'll just say a few words about it. So I think many people may be aware that greenhouse gases come in many, many flavors. The dominant one is carbon dioxide. But the second most prominent contributor to the greenhouse gas problem, to the climate change problem, is methane. And for much of the history of the climate negotiations, the dynamics of methane were underplayed. It is much nearer term in its effect. In other words, it has a higher effect in the near term than carbon dioxide because it's very potent. Over a long period, nowhere near as bad. But in the near term, we could actually prevent a lot of near-term climate if we could work on methane. One of the things that happened in Glasgow was a group of countries came together to pledge to really try to address the methane problem. It was led with a commitment to try to reduce 30% of methane emissions by the year 2030. So a very clean, very nice soundbite, but actually a real contribution. Government stepped forward, but didn't actually have any resources. And this was a place that actually philanthropy did step up. And philanthropy was able to put together a set of pledges that contributed several $100 million to helping develop both in-country capacity and projects that might lead to methane emissions reductions. It supported research, it supported policy development, it supported programs to help inform the public and the people who have a methane emission problem. That's been yielding quite a lot of good results. We've got a new team that's just been stood up since Glasgow under a methane partnership, which is really, really impressive. We've got a set of partners in the NGO world and in the government world who are working together. So it gives you some sense that that's possible. And they've been joined by companies who are actually part of both the solution and prior to this had been part of the emissions portfolio. So we're bringing together some really interesting partnerships, and this could be the kind of model that helps shape some of the answers, not just to methane, but to carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases. So I think in some ways the methane work is a really interesting signal of what could be done, quick turnaround, real results, and facts on the ground that are beginning to shift. So I'm quite pleased about how that particular piece has come forward.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. That's great. And if I could just add a footnote, because Wilson Center with Sandia Labs and others this summer has really, this last year has really taken a hard look at methane sources in the Arctic, not just oil and gas, but in particular permafrost. And as you know, and as most of the listeners probably know, methane releases from permafrost, which are increasing dramatically as permafrost thaws and collapses, are not fully accounted for in global climate models. So we have an additional challenge there in trying to monitor and assess Arctic methane sources, particularly from permafrost. And Wilson did, and Sandia did release a report on that. Just prior to the last Arctic Circle meeting, and is now anticipating developing, working on an architecture for permafrost methane integrated Arctic monitoring, which I think is a piece of this overall equation here.
That's super important to have that out there.
Great.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, for the conversation today. I think we've been able to cover a lot from international climate agreements, what to look forward to next week, but also a bit of hope with that there might be a model to look to with the global methane pledge to really see where this collaboration can happen amongst countries and leaders. So it's really been great to talk with you today and to have Sherry too and all the great conversation. We look forward to hearing from you again in the future.
Great. Thanks so much, Amanda. Thanks, Sherry. Great to see you and looking forward to seeing how this all unfolds as we all work on it together.
You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.